We are going to start a little bit out of order on the agenda. We're going to begin with item four, and we need a motion to adopt the amendment to the contract for 2014. Okay, we can hear from it first before we adopt it. Its approval of group insurance contract is being renewed or amended for 2014. Pursuant to 5 ILLCS 375-5, I make a motion to approve. May I have a motion to approve? A second? We will hold the roll open as more people come in, but a motion having been brought forward and seconded, the amendment is adopted. And we need to add Representative Poe to the roll. Let's call the roll on the motion, and then we'll leave it open after that. Okay, we would like to now bring up a representative to give us information on Medco, now Express Scripts.
Good morning. First one's up, so sorry about that. Thank you again for having us come in and speak to you all. We are representatives of Express Scripts Incorporated. My name is Donna Fleeg. I'm a Senior Director of Corporate Financial Services. And with me I have Tracy Young, who is an account director within our account team, to be able to answer any questions that you may or may not have. But first, I'd like to say, again, thank you for allowing us to be here, and we are the benefit providers since 2005 for the state, and we are proud in doing so, and we would appreciate, you know, your consideration for upcoming renewal of the contract.
Do we have any questions? And I would like to add Senator Farrick to the roll. Senator Stevenson.
Just one, are there any contractual differences from this year versus last, either now with due to the new name change or with this renewal? Are the coverages the same?
So the coverage is the same. However, we are doing reviews. Tracy's working with the benefits office to review potential changes that could bring savings to the state. And so those would be positive changes, of course, and that are, again, in review but not confirmed at this given point in time.
And the admin
fee is? There's nothing contractual.
Admin fee is, how does that compare to what?
It's the same
as last year or last contract? Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I had one. Do you have any pending regulatory issues with any state agency, or are you under investigation by the Attorney General or any other state Attorney General?
Not that we're aware of. We sent our SEC filings, did not find anything there, and have confirmed with our legal departments, and again, confirming no, nothing at this time.
And do you know if the claims hold issue has affected your responsibilities under our contract?
The claims hold issue meaning payments?
Yes.
Okay. The issues within the claims hold has been hardship for Express Scripts, cash flow issues. Our company model is that we hold separate contracts with our pharmacies, our retail pharmacies, and irregardless of whether or not Express Scripts is paid, we must make payment to those pharmacies within our contractual obligated time period. So therefore, our cash flow is essentially paid out and not received in, putting us in a negative situation.
Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next we'd like to have representatives from IMED, please.
Assistant General Counsel at IMED, and this is Sharon Mukes, the account manager, and we're here to answer any questions you have for us.
Senator Tigerson.
Thank you. The administrative cost is $44 million. That's going to be over a over 5 year period. Is this just administrative side where the claims are paid under a self-funded, or it's fully insured? It's a fully insured.
Fully insured.
And so is the. And so, what do you anticipate the cost to be? Is that included the administrative costs? Does that include your claims as well, or what do you?
It does include the claims costs as well.
So your annual costs are somewhere under $10 million a year. Total,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And then what is, so it's about under $10 million a year. That's total cost of the claims and the administrative portion of that. And what, it's probably hard to say, but do you know how much is covered in-network versus out-of-network with your claims?
Yeah, in-network is about 97%.
Your microphone's not on, I'm sorry.
Just follow it all the way down. Keep going down. There you go.
There you go.
Perfect. You're on.
I'm on?
Yes.
97% are in-network and about 3% out.
97% in-network? And is the reimbursement, you know, I raise this because the last time I think I went to, when I got my glasses, I think it was at Lens Crafters, and we went there and said, you know what, we have a sale going on. It's going to be cheaper if you just took a sale price and you never turned it into insurance. If you turn it into your insurance, you're going to pay more than what our sale price is. And I'm thinking then, you know, why are we paying for this insurance if it's going to be cheaper not to use the insurance? And so I guess my question is what are we gaining from this, or what are the employees really gaining?
I think the key thing is they're not limited to sale times. I mean, Lens Crafters maybe, you know, will have a 1 week sale, I don't know how many, six times a year. If you need your glasses at some other point in time, you're still able to use the benefit.
And that promotion might be limiting you to a certain type of frame, and your benefit allows you, you know, any selection.
Okay. And under the new contract, then, is that there'll be some contractual changes or improvements in the plan over current year. Is that
The one change that's being implemented on the state plan is the copays are increasing to $20 from $10.
From, but then are you also going then to annual lenses as opposed to biannual lenses?
I think the only change is on the copay.
Starting in 14, I think someone's waving yes. So in 14, 15. So starting in 15, then they'll go to annual lenses.
Anyone else, or you finished in? Again, I would like to ask the same question that I asked the previous panel. Are you under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state attorney general's office?
No, we are not.
And how has the claims hold issue affected your responsibilities under contract?
We're obligated to make payments to providers, and we are still making payments to providers.
Thank you. Following, do you think that the employees have sufficient knowledge of the vision benefits?
I do. It's been in place for many years, so they should.
Right. Thank you. Not seeing any further questions, we'll move on to the next panel, please.
Thank you.
That would be Fringe, the Fringe Benefit Management Company.
Good morning. My name is Scott Nixon. I'm with Fringe Benefits Management Company, a division of WageWorks. I'm the Senior Director of Client Services for our public sector office in Tallahassee. And with me is Dee Dee Bunch, who is the Account Services Consultant assigned to the state of Illinois. We're here and present and glad to answer any questions that you have.
Questions, Senator Stevenson?
Yes, with the changes in the laws coming forward, going forward, then is under the flex plans. What's going to be the? Is there going to be changes in the maximum allowed that can be put into the accounts?
Well, right now, because of health care reform, it's capped. The medical FSA is capped at $2,500. If there are going to be any changes to that, we're waiting to hear what those might be in the future. The dependent care is not going to change as far as we know. It's still capped according to tax filing status. But we're trying to keep the state of Illinois informed as we know things in terms of any compliance changes or changes to the cap.
And so we're still abiding by the $2,500 cap limit. And we still have the debit card that can be used
with the medical
with that plan as well.
That's correct.
And the number of employees that are using the dependent care, I think, does that say 1,600 here?
Around, well, for 2011, 2012, it was over 1,800.
1,800?
Yeah, so it might be slightly higher now.
Have we done any, and maybe this is more directed to the department, of more education on the utilization of, for many employees, depending on their tax situation, they're going to be better off using this as their dependent care than taking it off of their personal taxes at the end of the year. So it's not only better for them, but from a tax standpoint, it's better for us as well. So I don't know if we've thought about doing a better route of educating employees on the simplicity of using this and what the savings would be, but I guess I would encourage, I don't know if that's something that you've got the ability to do, to have a flyer or some information that can go out, or if we can integrate that into some pay or to some packet, some way to increase the utilization of dependent care through this model because of the savings it would be to the employee and to the state. And do you find that, again, that in most cases, better tax savings utilizing it through this as opposed to doing it through your taxes at the end of the year?
Yes, there is significant tax savings. Unfortunately, because it's capped in the way that participants would file their taxes, that there's generally, and you know, there's no generally there's no debit card option with the dependent care. So, on average, and I do a lot of annual performance reviews with a lot of states of whom are our clients, and because of the way the dependent care FSA is set up by law. Most of them average only 2% of their eligible base. Now, to answer your deeper question, can we do more communication? And I think as technology has evolved, we have grown with it, and so have our clients, and especially the state of Illinois. And we have the ability to do email campaigns, flyers, as you suggested. And I would comment by comparison with most states, the state of Illinois and Janice Bonneville and her team really engage and partner with us in trying to reach out to participants, whether it be during the annual benefit fair meetings or enrollment meetings, whatever the case. They are constantly engaged with us in trying to get more communication out, not just for the dependent care, but also for the commuter benefits as well as the medical FSA.
In the private sector, we have, I think, a much higher than a 2% utilization when it comes to that, and so there's a real savings. And last question, on the dependent care, if you have a set amount that you're paying each week for dependent care, for example, do you have to submit those claims each week, or do you have a set amount that the check would just go out on a routine or a regular basis?
Well, claims have to be filed as expenses are incurred. So as an expense is incurred with a date of service, you submit the receipt, and then you're reimbursed for that.
Okay, so even if it's an ongoing same amount, they have to actually submit that, and that can be done electronically.
Yes, it can.
So that doesn't become a real problem. I think on the prescriptions, where we're hooked up right with the pharmacy, and mm-hmm. it's done that way is really a lifesaver. And for those who aren't using it, again, it's a substantial savings to the employee to use that, and it's a real ease of using it with your program. So,
a majority of the expenses for folks who have a medical FSA and use a card are for pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
We watch that kind of data very closely. And, yes, the pharmacy benefit is extremely beneficial to the participant.
Yeah, and over the last 4 or 5 years, I know in the past there's been some concerns that have been raised, but I think over the last few years we've heard nothing but good things about the service that you're giving, so we appreciate that.
Great, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I would like to add Kelly Burke to the... Okay. Excuse me, sir. I was too quick. I didn't turn my page over. Just would want to ask you the same questions that I previously asked. Are you under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state Attorney General's office?
No, not to my knowledge.
And what changes exist in your renewed contract for 2014?
The changes, and I don't have the contract in front of me, but right now we're going through a system migration. We'll be moving participants to not a new system, but an existing system that has more options and tools. And the changes that we've made to the contract reflect the administrative changes in how we administer the contract, but the FSA, independent care, and commuter will be the same in terms of how it's administered by IRS law.
Thank you. Okay, now we're going to go back to agenda item number 2. I see our director of CMS, Malcolm Weeks, has arrived. So, sir, if you'd like to come up and advise us of the overview of the 2014 insurance program.
Thank you. Good morning to both chairs and the committee. My name is Malcolm Weems, Director of Central Medicine Services. I'm here joined today with you with Deputy Director of Benefits, Janice Bonneville. Again, thank you for allowing us to come and actually talk about what we think our plans are going to be for 2014 as it relates to group insurance. Again, there are still many moving parts. As you all know, we don't have a finished budget for 2014 yet, and there are still some contractual issues being settled. With that, I think what we kind of, in terms of the questions that were sent to us, we thought we would do more of a question and answer presentation for you all to answer any questions that specifically that the committee may have.
Senator Severson.
you House members, I tell you. Okay, we're going over the we're discussing both the current for active employees as well as the retirees. Is this line of questioning now, or are we just talking about active employee contracts?
Your choice, sir.
Okay.
I have my preference, sir, but
All right. Well, let's just run through the existing then first in our order. The first on the regular contracts with the Blue Cross Health Alliance, Coventry, as far as HMOs go, no changes in no significant changes we're looking at making. Contract issues are resolved and in place, so
no significant changes. We reached an agreement on the final contract about 5:45 last night.
Anything significant in that final agreement that's different? That
no, sir. I think the biggest thing that you may see is the impact of healthcare reform, because there is a tax issue for healthcare reform that kicks into place in January of 2014 of 2.5%. So that is figuring into all of our rates for this year.
Okay. And is that changing the employee contribution portion of it, or is that already been negotiated and that extra percent is going to be just something we're bearing in the budget?
The employee contribution has already been negotiated under the AFSCME contract, so those numbers are set. And so this is just as part of our normal renewal process for the contracts for the cost. The overall cost of the plan.
And what do we envision our overall cost increase to be? Not just, I guess, on the HMO, but under both the under open access as well as the quality care.
Overall cost increase.
What our medical inflation, including Obamacare costs, are going to.
Seven point four six percent
is what you anticipate your overall health cost increase. That is excluding the retiree contracts. Or that is just going to be your active employees under those.
These are the HMO rates for all employees and retirees.
Okay, for everyone, including retirees, under that. Okay. Have we been able to break down if we do something different for retirees, which I think is being discussed then, do we have any breakdown of the cost drivers, of whether or not it's the retirees versus the non-retirees?
Mm-hmm.
And is the non-retirees anticipating that same increase? And that 7.46, is that just for the HMO side, or is that what you envision for the OAPs and the Cigna as well? Okay, so 5.92 is what you are budgeting in this year's budget for on the HMO side of what your increased liability is going to be. And then on the...
If I may, too, just so I can introduce who you were speaking with. This is Marcia Armstrong. She works specifically in this area in benefits.
And then the OAP... that's staying the same then with the Coventry and Health Link, and is there an anticipation of the increased, what the growth is going to be in that sector?
In the OAP sector?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Bear with me, I've got a lot of numbers here. Our OAP sector overall, and this also has enrollment changes, so it's driven liability numbers that I've got in total, but it's also driven from changes in enrollment. We saw a huge spike in OAP enrollment. In FY12, we actually had an increase of 79.4%. So what we're actually seeing is more of our population moving from quality care to managed care, if you include the OAPs, and some of our costs actually on the quality care side have begun to drop, and on the managed care side, it's bearing out in some of the OAP plans. So while we had a huge increase in liabilities in FY12 due to enrollment changes, for 13, we had an increase of about 17%, and for 14, the increase is projected at 3.2%. And we're continuing our enrollment trends. As we've seen the OAP, I've averaged them without using the outliers. So barring any huge migration and additional migration to OAP, it's starting to level out now.
So we're anticipating 3.2% increase. Now that's, okay. And that's including all of the new, any costs associated with the implementing and cost shifting occurring and everything that's going to happen with the...
These rates include everything that was quantifiable for liability changes and plan design changes. We have future program changes that will be incorporated in future rates. For example, some of the Medicare coordination of benefits. So that we have some amounts that have been negotiated, but when we do our self-insurance and our self-claim rates, they're blended over a four-year period. And we have to be conservative. We also have to make sure that we're fully charging all other state funds. So as we work through the modeling, I would say the more current year is weighted only as much as 25%. So a lot of these cost savings, they're probably more on the side of cost avoidance. As of right now, the rates are still set based on actual experience, and as we move forward with these new programs, the rates will be adjusted and reconciled, and it will bear out in future years.
Okay. And then last year, Cigna, under the self-funded portion, under the Cigna, what do we anticipate that growth rate to be?
Cigna overall, including some enrollment shifts. We've seen, of course, some enrollment shifts from active to retiree. So there's been some cost adjustments there because in the past, of course, active employees have paid more than retirees. And so moving forward, that may adjust out somewhat, but the overall increase is about 7.3%.
Okay. and that's what we anticipate, that's basically what you think your medical inflation is going to be when it comes to the claims?
Medical inflation, migration, you know, it may be affected moving forward based on our Medicare coordination and our Medicare plans. So I expect that as we have actual experience, a lot of our savings are with Medicare coordination, so we may see more savings in the Medicare population than we do in some of the other populations.
And under the new arrangement, Cigna is going to go away then for our Medicare primary retiree population. Is that right?
To a certain extent, whatever product we move forward for Medicare moving forward in fiscal year in January of next year, we have some system issues where we won't simply have the entire Medicare population. There are a couple of things. For instance, we can't enroll members and dependents in different plans. So if a Medicare primary member has a non-Medicare primary dependent, that member can't be rolled off of a plan that currently exists. Depending on the product we go to, it may have an impact on our Medicare Prime members who have ESRD, our Medicare Prime members that are active employees. So there are some exceptions to the rule.
Right, okay. What do we anticipate our backlog of unpaid, or what is our current backlog of unpaid insurance bills currently stand at?
Currently, for all four programs, including TRIP, SIP, and local government, it's about $1.6
billion. $1.6 billion. And how many months backlog is that?
On average, 9 months to 12 months. 12 months more on our self-insured claim side and 9 to 10 months on the HMO side.
On the 12-month side, if we exceed the 12 months, how does that work under the current law where if after 12 months you have to go to court of claims? And are we doing something different?
We can pay group insurance claims from any fiscal year, and we have 2 years of run out naturally. So we have the ability to pay those old claims out of future appropriations.
Okay. So providers don't have to go into, after our claims delays get to be over 12 months, providers don't have to go through the court of claims to get recourse. We can still go through and
that's correct. We can still pay those normally. They do not have to go through court of claims.
And do we anticipate in this year's budget, is the our unpaid bills going to be increasing, staying flat, or are we going to be making headway on unpaid?
The estimate for state is about $1.8 billion by the end of fiscal year 13, and we anticipate holding that about flat into FY14 based on actual experience from the savings driven from the contract.
So this year we're going to increase unpaid by $200 million, and then with all the savings we're putting into place, we won't make any headway. We'll just be flat at that still, $1.8 billion of unpaid bills.
We could come in lower than 1.8 as we move through some of our savings and our new projects. But as of right now, it's projected to be about flat.
And how does any of this money qualify for prompt pay interest? And are we?
Yes, we have timely pay interest for the actual claims that go to the providers. That's the 9% timely pay interest. And then for the administrative fees and the HMO payments, that's prompt payment interest, which is the 12%.
Now, is that 12%, though, after what date? Is that
90 days.
90 days after the claim is approved and sent to the comptroller's office?
Correct. 90 days from receipt of a good bill, a good claim.
So when it's received, not when it's approved or sent to the comptroller's office?
I believe it's 90 days, including approval, all the approval processes.
Okay. Approval being defined as?
The agency and the comptroller's office. 90 days from the day that you receive it and stamp it as accepted to the day that it actually, the warrant is issued.
When the warrant is issued to go to the comptroller's office,
when it's released from the controller's office, and then the interest is driven from the date of release of that payment from the controller's office to the provider.
Okay. So what?
I want to make sure that you understood that. So the invoice, when it arrives at the calculate what the interest is until the warrant is issued, until the check is cut from the comptroller's office. Does that make sense? So the 90 days starts once the agency has approved it. And then it'll, you know, depending on what time or what date, you send it over to the comptroller to be paid. What you do is you take 90 days from there, and then the agency calculates what the interest will be. Okay, but they can't calculate it until the comptroller actually pays the bill.
But the interest starts on, so you receive the claim, and how long does it take from when you receive the claim before someone looks at it to actually approve that claim?
We approve it immediately upon receipt. We reconcile to membership records, make sure that the counts are correct, and then we approve it as received.
So it's approved right away. So then 90 days from that approval date is when the interest, the clock starts running, but it's not calculated out until after it goes to the comptroller. And how much has been paid this year in interest payments?
Well, we think we'll owe as much as $80 million between prompt payment and timely payment interest.
Okay.
We're catching up some old prompt payment interest that moved over from HFS. So a lot of what we've paid so far this year has actually been catch-up. But I believe we've paid out at least $28 million to date. But we have more to pay out.
Okay. Do we have prompt payment interest on the prompt payment interest?
No. No.
Okay. All right. Then let's move quickly over to the retiree changes that you are looking at implementing. At this point, the discussions were looking at going to a single source plan for retirees, qualified retirees. And is that being looked at as going to a Advantage plan, or what was agreed to in your contract with the?
The agreement under the AFSCME contract is a Medicare Advantage plan. It is not limited to an HMO or PPO or one or the other. That is what the department is currently exploring right now. The department did release an RFI last fall and received multiple responses to that RFI. That RFI was not limited to a Medicare Advantage plan. It left the options open to the responders to provide us with information in their expertise of what would be the optimum choice for the state of Illinois.
And so has a decision been made then of what plan or what course of action is going to be taken, or what was negotiated then with the final AFSCME contract of what that contract is going to look like?
No final decisions have been made, but the AFSCME contract does indicate a Medicare Advantage plan.
And was it any discussions of what the Advantage plan would look like?
The agreement was that the Advantage plan would be similar in design to the plan that currently exists, that retirees currently have access to, both on the quality care side and on the managed care side.
Okay. How does the Advantage plan is going to usually have is going to be a plan that's going to have it's going to be a copay driven type plan, which would be different from the, obviously, the quality care plan that they had before. So in the negotiations, there's no discussion of what that quality care coverage would be, or which is mirror what the current coverages are.
The discussions was a mirror or something comparable. Originally, the discussion was actuarially comparable. Now it's comparable with respect to the plan design changes that have been made to go into effect in fiscal year 14. So the design that the retirees would in theory see from July until December will be consistent with the design that they see beginning in January.
The majority of retirees, are they under the, they're under the, they'd be under the Cigna self-funded?
Currently the majority of retirees are under quality care, but as Marcia indicated, we did see some migration from quality care into the OAPs over the last year. given the large number of retirees in quality care, that migration is happening on both the active and the retiree side.
Okay. And this would have a pretty significant change in our network. So from going from quality care where you can virtually go anywhere, then to depending on who you select as your advantage plan, there would be a much stricter migration or steerage into a network.
The state would be procuring a PPO for the advantage plan, so as with other contracts that we've addressed in the past, the goal would be to look at the networks available to us, both in the state and out of the state. Going to a PPO plan would give us some flexibility on in and out of network benefits under that advantage plan, similar to what folks have right now under quality care that live outside of the network area.
And what do you anticipate that cost to be if you have an advantage plan that's going to have either a larger network or have richer benefits? That's obviously going to take away from the potential savings of what you would have in a traditional advantage plan. Have you calculated out what you anticipate your average monthly cost is going to be under that?
Not at this time, no.
How do we come up with the number of the $250 million of savings if we're not sure what the cost per...
That was a calculated number based upon the design as it was put forward. We worked on the retiree health care piece with Deloitte. They were under contract with GOMB, and they provided us data with regard to looking at the design as it was posed at the union table and what that impact would be from a Medicare Advantage standpoint if that was the design that we moved forward with.
And did they, what kind of sample did they, in their modeling, what kind of plan design and networking did they use in that?
They used the design that exists now that is moving forward for 14. In terms of enrollment numbers, they had all of the enrollment numbers. They were assisting us as well on the retiree health care premium piece. So they had all the enrollment numbers for retirees and their dependents as they currently existed for the plan at the time the discussions on Medicare Advantage were occurring.
Okay. If the coverages are going to be similar and the networks are going to be similar to what we're currently doing, where does the savings end up occurring, or how do we get that savings? I thought normally with the Advantage plan, the savings is going to be stricter network, tighter management, use of copays to direct behavior. If our coverages are going to be similar, how do we generate that 116 or 115 million or whatever that savings is going to be?
The Medicare Advantage plan will be a fully insured product on both sides, so we'll have some adjustment in terms of risk. Obviously, there's arguments being made whether or not that is to our benefit or to our detriment. But the focus of the plan is simply to move those retirees to a product that is similar but still within the control of the state to be able to hopefully effectuate savings under that move. Obviously, we're counting on savings on this piece, but we have a lot of work to do to move this forward come January 1.
Now, we've heard some discussions about a Medigap option. Is with this legislation, this agreement at this point, is it strictly an Advantage plan that is being discussed and implemented, and is there a deadline for that, or are you exploring the discussions we've heard about, some discussions about of Medigap plans? Is that being looked at as well?
Well, initially, my initial comments were that the union contract indicates Medicare Advantage, and that is the path we are headed down. The legislation that is pending does nothing to either expand or contract the director's right to seek contracts for retirees and active employees for health care. The legislation is designed to give some relief from the procurement code so that, given the short time frame, because of the extended length of contract negotiations and the desire to move this into place as soon as possible, meaning January of next year, we sought relief from the procurement code, still with oversight from the CPO's office, to allow us to move this forward, given what needs to be done. January implementation means a enrollment at the end of the calendar year, which means a contract in place in September or October which means that as each day passes, the window of opportunity to make that procurement occur gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
I think the question is, did the legislation that's moving forward or the agreement specify advantage plans?
The legislation moving forward does not specify the product, no.
It doesn't specify the product?
No, sir.
The only agreement then with the union is that the product may be similar, but
the,
nothing more.
The union contract specifically says Medicare Advantage.
Okay. So if the contract says it has to be Advantage, but you're not locked into doing that, I guess I'm confused then. Do you have an option to do something additional than Advantage if the contract says it has to be Advantage?
There's always an option under Section 5 of the Group Insurance Act to procure benefits. But for purposes of this discussion, it is our intent to move forward under the terms of the bargaining agreement to go to a Medicare Advantage product.
Okay. Is there going to be, is there an RFP out there at all for Medigap options being looked at?
There's not an RFP. There were some responses to the RFI, a limited number that spoke to Medigap, but the vast majority of the responses to the RFI spoke to Medicare Advantage, and we can certainly share those. I've shared those with the committee that heard the bill the other day in the Senate, and we can certainly share those with this committee as well.
Okay, and that would be a single source Advantage plan?
Well, we're looking at both the PPO and an HMO contract. Are potential, so there's the potential for multiple contracts to be awarded for this product.
Okay.
I'm very sensitive to the need to cover the membership in the way that they've been inclined to be covered in the past.
Yeah, and the prescription drug coverage, is that going to be, would that be similar to what they've had before as well, or would there be a change like with
right now, we use prescription drug coverage. We use the retiree drug subsidy with the feds, and the intent would be to move to an employer group waiver program, an EGWP, with a wrap, which would be a standardized formulary with a wrap around so that we can incorporate some items of our own current formulary into that wrap.
I have no idea what you just said, but it sounded really good.
At least I explained what an EGWP was rather than just say EGWP and hope that you knew. An employer group waiver program, the RDS subsidy is becoming less and less. That's the retiree drug subsidy under federal health care. So because we cover our retirees rather than force them to a Part D plan, we submit quarterly to the feds the amount of money we spend, and they pay us a subsidy back for our costs. Moving forward into Medicare Advantage, it would be to move to a different kind of pharmacy benefit. An employer group waiver program, which is takes the drug subsidy out and so gives you greater savings on the front end, but then because those are more standardized, the wrap gives you the option to bring in some of your own formulary so that we could keep the formulary something similar to what we have in place right now. And ESI will remind me that formularies are always in flux, to make sure that we're covering the pharmacy needs of the population.
Okay. Last question. So I'm trying to get an understanding of this. Our current retiree costs, I think, are somewhere around $440, $445, something like that. Is your average? Is our average cost per Medicare eligible retiree going to the Advantage plan model? Have they given you what they believe under those models, your average retiree cost is going to be that equivalent to what that $440, $445 number is?
I don't believe I have it broken down by head. I just have the total number as was presented during the course of the contract negotiations.
Okay. Could we calculate that? Because if we're talking about anywhere from $116 million or we've heard up to $200 million or something in savings, to get that savings, we must have an average per cost to be able to compare that to the existing retiree cost to come up with that, with what that number would be based on a similar, if our, based on a certain coverage model as well. So if they were creating a model that had coverages that were similar to, as you described it, and then what would they anticipate those costs, especially if that's going to be a fully insured Advantage plan, we should be able to have a pretty solid number then of what that rate would, what that rate would be, average for that retiree model. And then does that, if we, if the retirees are all moved into that population, what does that do to the under 65 year overall loss ratio? Does that have any effect on what your average cost is if you're, if your over 65 population is now migrating out of your Cigna population?
I would expect there would be some adjustments. It's not an adjustment run that we've made at this point, but yes, I would expect there would be adjustments to be made for the loss ratio for the folks that are under, for the retirees that are under age 65.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. I would like to add Representative Neckerts to the roll, and then proceeding with questions, we'll have Representative Tryon, Senator Co-Chair, Representative Poe, and then our co-chair, Senator Frerich.
Yes, so when you're looking at the migration from quality care into the OAP, is that primarily because of costs or a larger OAP network, or both? I mean, what do you see driving people from the PPO into an OAP?
I think it's a combination of both. The OAP rates are lower for fiscal year 13, so that and it gives people a little bit more flexibility. They have some ability to have a much lower rate if they've got a doctor that's in tier one. I think initially, given the last 2 years, folks who perhaps hadn't looked at an OAP plan previously were taking a closer look at an open access plan over these 2 years and getting some more understanding of what that plan actually did or didn't do, so that they could decide if it made sense for them to make that transition.
So, and also then at HMOs, costs have been going up, correct, to the actual employee?
The HMO costs have been going up to the actual employees. The OAPs, I mean, all of the costs of the employee are going up in fiscal year 14, regardless of which plan they're enrolled in.
Mm-hmm. Would part of that, if I'm in an OAP, the OAP actually pays the provider on a different schedule than the quality care plan would, right? I mean, if you have Cigna managed quality care plan, your provider is getting paid in 9 to 12 months, correct? What is the provider being paid time frame wise on an OAP plan?
The OAPs are also at about 9 to 10 months right now. They're about on pace with the HMOs. Cigna's a little bit higher, but we've actually tried to make the time frames equal across our plans. So as we've looked at our payment schedules, we've tried to keep everybody at a minimum of 9 months, maximum of 12 months.
So when you refer to cost avoidance as being a factor in between the different systems, you're talking about the participant avoiding costs one way or the other, right? Or
well, when I was talking about cost avoidance, it was driven more by the savings that we're projecting through our plan design changes. You know, we still have inflation, we still have pressures, so you may not be able to look at a piece of paper and see a straight savings based on plan design changes. So the cost avoidance was more in light of these savings will roll through our rates and we'll see those in future years.
So you're talking about change in things like co-pays, that kind of stuff.
More driven towards the Medicare plan when that is implemented and the savings that we see there, Medicare coordination of benefits, wellness committee, there's some savings that will bear out as we move forward.
And not to mention the fact that since we're so far behind on our payments, we're actually paying based on the rates that were established in FY12, FY13. So, you know, while we'll have savings in our actual claims, we're not really even paying for those claims until FY15.
Right. So when we're looking at the Meta, the Advantage plan, or I think it's Medigap, so an Advantage plan is something we actually are going to know more about what the actual cost is, right? And the Medigap plan would actually have a lot more variables in it that could change up or down. Would that be kind of a correct?
The Medigap plan is a standardized plan across the market.
Okay.
So you would be purchasing a plan. They're run by letter. So you're purchasing a standardized plan in the marketplace for a Medigap.
So what, then the Advantage plan is more like a quality care plan type thing?
Or an HMO. It's something that we can set the plan design. So similar to the way that we do the RFPs for our other plans, say this is the design for the state of Illinois and getting a bid based upon that design.
So then the Medigap plan is more like this is what it is wherever you're at, correct?
Correct.
Okay, but we're not being asked to make a decision on that in any time soon, correct? Or?
Not today, sir.
Not today. When are we going to be looking at that? I think I need education on what the plan differences are and so forth.
We'll do the best we can to keep this committee as up to date on what our progress is and where we are with it. The timing of this is such that our standard meeting, our next standard meeting would be after this procurement has been let and has been awarded and has been implemented.
Well, I don't want to make that mistake.
I understand,
again.
Sir. I understand, sir. So it would be my commitment to this committee to say that, you know, as we move down this process, we'll do whatever we can to meet with folks individually or to talk to folks about where we are in the process and what our progress is.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Representative Poe.
A little bit about the retiree side of it. Now, under the contract, then all retirees from all five systems are handled the same way in
yes,
the contract?
Sir.
I guess my question is, then, in 1999, for university employees, Public Act 91395 was signed into law. That gives the nudists at that time, the universities, they could take the cost-free health insurance by giving up benefit improvements provided in Public Act 9065. So these people, let's say they retired right after that, they've been paying 10, 12 years, they give up some benefits to make sure they could have their insurance. Now, are they in this same group or were they excluded from this contract?
Well, they're not part of the contract, but they're part of the director's discretion under Senate Bill 1313. So what the contract is it sets the premium rates for retirees under SERS and state TRS. That's the retirees that are impacted by the AFSCME contract. And sets those rates at 1% for fiscal year 14 for Medicare eligible retirees and 2% for non-Medicare. Both of those numbers double in fiscal year 15. That's a percentage based upon the total annuity paid to that individual from all five state systems. So from an operational standpoint, that will be spread across all five systems. So it will apply to General Assembly judges, SURS, SERS, and state TRS. For the folks that were retired under 91-395, the terms of that act specifically exempt them from the application of 90-65. 90-65 is
right.
The 5% rule. The 5% rule under the new system is still in place. So if a person retires today under SERS and has 15 years of service, they're going to pay 25% of the cost of health care plus either 1% or 2% of their annuity towards their premium. So for folks that have 20 or more years or folks under 91-395, their base is going to be zero, just like it always has been. And then the additional 1% or 2% this year or 2% or 4% next year is on top of that.
I guess my question is, though, what happened to those ones that give up those benefits for the last 12 years possibly and to take the free insurance? Now, all of a sudden, they've missed out on 12 years of benefits so they could have free health insurance.
The trade-off, The trade-off for the benefit was not to have to pay under the 5% rule. So
right.
That person who had 15 years of service, they should have paid 25% of the cost for the last 12 years. They haven't paid anything, nor will they be charged anything under that 5% rule moving forward.
So it'll almost be just like that went away, and we're going to start with the way without that option.
Well, it's still there. Someone today could still retire under 91-395. Someone on the 2nd of July could still retire under 91-395. The benefit of that law was if you have less than 20 years of
right.
service, you don't have to pay the 5%.
And more than 8, right?
Well, for SURS,
right.
it's 5.
Right. Okay.
So somewhere between 5 and 20.
So you think it's just a wash and it'll work out and...
I think that we're still meeting the requirements of 91-395.
Okay. And then the other thing on the ASME contract, could you tell me what the wellness savings are for $53 million?
Sure. The wellness savings are calculated. There is a rather extensive study done by Harvard that's used industry-wide when you're talking about wellness savings that calculates savings at approximately $348 per person. At the bargaining table, we agreed, the management and union agreed to use that number as our target for savings for wellness. It has been vetted. It has been used by multiple entities. It uses small employer, medium employer, large employer, states to come up with an average savings for wellness moving forward, starting with something as simple as an HRA and then moving to a more aggressive program. We actually anticipate more than $53 million. But $53 million is the base. And I have that actually in front of me, but that's something else that I would certainly be welcome to share with the committee if you want to see how we use those numbers.
And the definition of wellness then in this case is?
Well, right now wellness is a flu shot. So our hope is to give us something more than that. But, again, it's a start with an HRA, a health risk assessment, and it's moving forward to things like coaching, to modifications to co-payments for behavior, things of that nature as we move forward. We have a very substantial labor management committee that we use for health care. We started using them early on in this administration and have found savings with that committee, and that committee will be not only working with us for additional savings, they'll be also intimately involved in the wellness process.
Thank you.
Are there other questions of commission members? This is something that's all very new to me, and I'm a little slow to understand. So. Pardon me for some of my questions, and I'm sure there will have more questions going forward that the commission will be asking and looking forward to some answers. Is there a method for delivering both Medicare Advantage and Medicare supplemental plans and allowing retirees to choose which works best for them? I don't quite understand.
That is something we're exploring. There are some very definitive rules about once you get into one, how you can get out and get into another. So we're trying to make sure that we don't cut off our nose and spite our face, and we also don't put a retiree in a plan that simply isn't working for them.
Okay. Which method delivery gives retirees the most health care options going forward?
Well,
no matter where they live in the country.
It depends. Medigap is driven by, it mirrors or shadows, I guess I should say, traditional Medicare. So if the provider takes traditional Medicare, then they'll take the Medigap. So Medicare Advantage, if we have a limit to a network, an HMO, you're going to be limited to that network just like you are now under an HMO product. Under a PPO product, they would have in-network and out-of-network services. So, again, as long as they've got a Medicare provider, they can go to an in-network or an out-of-network provider.
Okay. And so it's my understanding that many large private sector employers are delivering retiree benefits via Medicare exchanges now. Is that your understanding?
It is.
Okay. Rather than just through one insurer, is there a reason we've chosen? Can you explain the reason why we've chosen to go this route?
Well, although I've referred to it a couple times today, I don't want to go back down that path. But in the last few years, it's become very clear. From my standpoint, not having procurement before this year, our focus has always been on the member-facing side of this plan. As we move forward with different procurements over the last few years, we've been very careful to make sure that we're still meeting the needs of the membership, even as we run down the path of where are the savings for the state? So I've been very cautious about what are we going to do, what are we going to put our retirees into, what are their options going to be, how are we going to make sure that not only does it give them the benefits that they're used to, but also gives them a resource through us to make sure that we can assist them as they move down that path, rather than just say, okay, here are all of your options, pick one. That seems a little bit more harsh to me.
Okay. Oh, the clerk, please ask Mr. Kaler the rolls. Okay. Co-Chair Tracy?
Thank you. I believe the House is about ready to go into session, so we'll try to wrap this up. But, and we may, I know we're just the tip of the iceberg at this point. I had a question. My assistant, who is under the state health care employee, had a situation where it took CMS or the provider, well, through the insurance process or health insurance, it took over a year for them to determine whether or not they were going to pay for whatever services it was she had. But by the time that the state insurance made its and I would have to check whichever that was, but by the time they made up the determination, her secondary insurance time had expired, and so then she had to bear the brunt of the full, and so she ended up with no coverage for the procedures of whatever. And I'm just wondering, I've heard other constituents have similar problems, and I don't know where, how we address that or wherein lies the problem.
I guess my question is, was it a year to determine if we were even going to cover the benefit?
Yes.
Not a year for us to pay as primary?
No, it was a year to determine if it would be covered.
I'm not in a position to respond to that situation, but I can certainly get in touch with your office.
Okay, well, we'll follow. I mean, I didn't know. I've heard similar complaints from whether it be retirees or the like, and, you know, along with several other things. Next question, I know you've been asked a lot of things, and I hope we're not redundant here, but I know under law there's specific data that's been requested traditionally every year from CMS, and this year it seemed like the data was not delivered timely, and so we didn't have that. Is there a reason for that, that it's unusual that in the past all this data has been made available because it is pursuant to law?
Are you speaking of the money data, the finance data, or are you speaking to contracts?
Well, all the insurance health data that would be due April 1st.
Again, I'm asking, are you speaking to contracts or are you speaking to finance?
It's both.
Both? Well, the contracts are not yet finalized. They were listed in the data that was provided. We sent, when did we send the finance data?
I think the original data was sent by budget address, which was March 6th or 7th, and then we had follow-up data that was submitted March 26th. With all the most current data that we had at that time, we just finished negotiating HMO rates last night at 5:45, so it wasn't possible to incorporate any new data into the exhibit, so we will be going through them again one more time, updating it with all of the final data and resubmitting. But it was a combination of the delay in union negotiations. You know, I guess it goes without saying that this is the latest in history that it's ever been negotiated. I think it was finalized the end of February. So to turn around and get the CASA materials out by March 6th or 7th was actually a pretty substantial effort. And then we've been updating them as we get more data.
Well, likewise, I think we're unable to prepare our budget projections as well due to that. So we're dependent on you for that information. I would ask in your opinion, do you have any opinion whether the Medicare Advantage that we've been discussing and the Medigap has greater cost savings one way or the other for the state?
I don't have an opinion on that at this point. I know that we're looking at both paths, but again, the Medicare Advantage language is what was agreed to the bargaining table, so that's the path we've been heading down more fervently.
Were there ever projections made? I mean.
Yeah, approximately $214 million over two years, so from January of next year, because it runs on the Medicare Advantage would have to start on the calendar year. So approximately $214 million in calendar year 14 and calendar year 15.
But utilizing the Medicaid Advantage rather than Medigap?
Using Medicare Advantage, yes, ma'am.
Okay, was there ever a projection using Medigap?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. I'll turn this over to Co-Chair Frerichs.
I see no further questions from the Commission. We'll be looking forward to some more correspondence with CMS going forward. Thank you very much for coming in, Director.
Thank you.
Okay, so what time is it?
Do we still have to run through the each of the other carriers that we haven't Do we have to go through the other carriers and
yes.
go through your normal?
Yeah.
All right, you're going to be doing that. We can probably take a couple of them at a time. We don't have any real issues, so if you want to.
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, so we're going to go ongoing health contracts for fiscal year 2014. I'll start with HMOs, Blue Cross Blue Shield. Any representatives here? You can come forward. Health might be up next.
Hello.
Okay.
I'm Joanne Wetzel. I'm the Divisional Vice President for Blue Cross Blue Shield.
And I'm Tanel Barnes. I'm the Senior Manager of Municipal Accounts at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois.
Okay. Are there any questions from the Commission?
No, we're good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's see if we move this very quickly then. Health Alliance, if you want to come forward, and Coventry will be up next, if anyone is here.
Good morning. I'm Lori Cadre-Benso, Senior Vice President and General Counsel with Health Alliance, and with me is Sinead Rice-Madigan, our Director of Government Relations. And we're looking forward to any questions that you have.
Senator Poe.
I got a promotion.
Representative Poe. And I'm glad you acknowledge that as a promotion.
I'm awake. And I probably should have asked the last time, but we're going to see no big shift in our membership out of this new contract, are we?
Most likely not. I mean, we're expecting.
I probably should have asked.
Yeah.
No? Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, we'll keep moving on. Try and get the House up to the floor on time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coventry.
Good morning. I'm Roman Kulich, President and CEO of Coventry Healthcare of Illinois and Missouri, and with me today is Michael Wolf, Executive Director of Coventry Healthcare of Illinois.
Any questions? Senator Stevenson? Okay. We'll see no questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Since the House is about to go in, we do have an open motion, and we've had a few members join the Commission since it was opened. Would the clerk please call a roll for approval of group insurance contracts being renewed or amended fiscal year 2014. For those who weren't there, I'll reread it. Pursuant to 5 ILCS 375-5, I make a motion to approve the proposed renewed and amended versions of the following contracts for fiscal year 2014, Medco, IMED, and Fringe Benefit Management Company. Will the clerk please call the roll? Yes. Okay. Thank you. Open access plans. Coventry was up here earlier. Is there anyone on the commission that would have any separate questions regarding OAPs for Coventry? Seeing none. HealthLink. Do we have anyone here from HealthLink?
Good morning. Mark Hagley with Director of Sales for HealthLink. And with me is Susan Laney, the Account Manager for HealthLink.
Okay. Any questions? Well, no concerns. It's going very smoothly. Thank you very much. All right. And if we keep up this pace, we'll be out here soon. Other providers, anyone from Cigna?
Good morning. I'm Debbie Robertson, National Account Executive with Cigna, and Carol Lemke, Client Engagement Manager, with me.
Okay. One second. Do you have a question? Co-chair.
Thank you. As far as the claim hold, what impact has that had with your agency, or your company?
We continue to process claims timely. They go into a check hold before they're released to the providers based upon a schedule that the state dictates to us. Right now, it's between 45 and 55 weeks, 9 to 12 months, 10 to 12 months, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Severson.
And your providers, they're all not necessarily okay with this, but under the contracts you have with your providers, they have to abide by those that agreement with that time frame?
We do have instances where they have been in arbitration with us for claim payment. We do have incidences where they are refusing to see state members, but they are generally very easy. I mean, they do work with us on that, so they do understand the importance of continuing to see state members and treat state members.
And their ability to bill patients, are they delaying on that payments, or do most of them have the sophisticated enough electronic system to be able to bill the what is an estimated what would be the employee portion of that?
Yes, they receive an early advance explanation of payment, so they're able to identify what the member would owe of their portion and can collect that up front before they receive payment.
Okay, so when that patient receives a billing from the doctor's office, the provider's office, it'll show what the anticipated insurance payment's going to be,
yes,
what the employee portion of it is. So it's easy for the employee standpoint to figure out what they owe and have to pay, so it doesn't create a billing problem down the road when those payments come in.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And all the payments have been approved at that point. When you adjudicate it just like you would any other claim, you just don't actually write the check.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So can you tell me what amount you have on hold between the 45-55-week range?
Currently it's at $507
million. $507 million. How does that compare to where we were last year?
It's slightly more.
Slightly more?
Yes, sir.
Okay, no further questions.
Okay, further questions? Up to the three.
Just to follow up, I had mentioned that I had a constituent situation where untimely determination was made. How many, do you log in how many complaints you receive from state employees or retirees?
We don't have a specific mechanism for that, no.
Okay, do you have a complaint resolution method?
The state does, I think. There was 126 filed last year. The state keeps track of that information.
We don't keep specific track of those that are state employees, no ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. See no further questions. Thank you very much for your time. Next up, Delta Dental. Your representatives.
Good
Karen Glogowski. I'm the Vice President responsible for sales and service for Delta Dental. And with me I have Darren Avant, who is the manager of Key Public Accounts that serves the state of Illinois. So we're ready to answer any questions you may have about the dental plan.
Okay. Questions? Senator Severson.
Just a quick one. I should know this. Is this a fully insured plan or self-funded?
It is self-funded.
Self-funded. And how are the payments, same payment cycle issues under the dental as it is with the medical side as well?
Well, we do pay the network providers in a shorter condensed time frame than we pay non-network providers, which actually has resulted in us growing the network fairly substantially.
Okay. And most of yours are the amount of in-network versus out-of-network is what percentage of yours is going to be in-network?
82% of the dollars are spent for in-network providers and 84% of procedures.
Okay. And in-network, do you have different types of networks? Do you have different levels of providers?
We do. We have the PPO network, which is a deeper discounted network and smaller, and then what we consider the safety net network, which is called the Premier Network, and that is a much larger network than the PPO. It still provides the protection of contractual provisions as well as savings.
But a different discounted?
That is correct.
Okay, same thing for the employee participation amount or the balance would be higher in that secondary network?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Do you have any comments regarding the vendor assistance program and have you made use of it?
We have elected not to participate with the vendor assistance program.
Okay. And why?
Our CFO had actually made that decision a few weeks ago, and we have not had time to circle back with her to understand what the reasoning was behind that decision, but we would be happy to provide that to the committee.
Okay. Representative Fryan.
So, as far as I know, I have a dentist that's in the network, and he no longer, I have to pay first, and then he reimburses me when he gets paid. And I'm hearing that's kind of a standard thing with dentists in the area that we're at. So, what is your payment cycle for reimbursement of people in network?
For network providers, the current hold time is 13 weeks, and for non-network providers, 45 weeks.
45 weeks.
But he, as a matter of practice, he should not be collecting from you up front. So if we could have his name, we'll take him down.
Okay. Well, I believe there are a lot of, well, he may have gotten out. I don't know. I mean, he doesn't tell me what to do. He says, we no longer, wait for payment. You're going to have to pay it. So I'd assume the benefit is I get the same dentist with rates you've negotiated. But let me ask you this. What dollar amount do you have at the 45-week level, and what dollar amount do you have at the 13-week level?
As far as hold?
From the whole, yeah.
The dollar amount at the at the 45-week level is $58 million, and I don't have the number for a network at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Severs, once again.
Yeah, just follow up. I guess I'm a little concerned. So your in-network providers get paid sooner than out-of-network. I guess what authority, as opposed to first in, first out on claims, what authority are we giving you to punish a dentist that's not in that network by having them wait additional 30 weeks just because they won't sign up with your network? Is that decision you make on that, or is that decision that the state makes?
It's a decision that we've jointly made.
So you jointly decided to say, if you don't join our network, we're going to make you wait an extra 40 weeks to get paid?
Well, I think the motivation behind it was attempting to make sure that we could save the state as much money as possible. So through the benefit of the network's contractual provisions and protections, The state has saved a significant amount of money.
You're saving
moving
money
into
on your
network.
Network discounts already, and you're having to pay prompt payment, aren't you, for those interest payments that are going out 40-some weeks? So you're already getting the steers. I don't think we do that for medical providers, punishing them for not being in network, because you already have your out-of-network penalties. We already have that in dentistry. You already have your out-of-network penalties.
The motivation, though, was to incent dentists, particularly around the Springfield area, to join the network to make sure that we would have additional
not
savings.
Not it's blackmailing. It's saying if you don't join us in our network, we're not going to pay you. I guess that's a little, I'm a little concerned that we have that kind of a differential between in-network and out-of-network. And I guess I'm concerned if that's a decision that the state has made to be a partner to punishing somebody because they have chosen to go out of network over and above that the penalty they're already getting for being out of network. That's a pretty significant difference, I think, against those dentists that aren't in the network. They're already having to be, the employee is already paying a larger portion, and that dentist is going to get reimbursed at a lower rate already. So now we're going to reimburse the dentist at a lower UNC, and then we're not going to pay them for 40 additional weeks.
They do receive the interest on the monies that have been put in the lag.
And how much have we paid out in interest on this then?
The 9% prompt pay interest.
The 9% on those dollars?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we ought to be looking at that. Again, I don't like the idea of punishing someone because they refuse to join a network. And so I hope we look at that and pay claims first in, first out, which also should help us on the interest payment as well. If we're paying in network sooner, and the old ones are extending out, we're paying interest that we wouldn't necessarily have to pay out. So I hope we take a look at that.
Senator Feeley.
On the other hand, though, I think that there's also a business decision that is made on the part of a dentist. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why they might choose to be in a network or not in the network. And the end result is if we don't offer any incentives, then what it does is it ends up costing the state more money. Therefore, we get fewer dental services for that. I mean, I used to negotiate hospital contracts and physician contracts, and I think this is just a business model that that makes some sense.
Well, the incentive is already there in the contract, in the negotiated rate, in the discounts that the employees pay and not pay. So it's the in and out of network penalty like you have with health insurance. So
right.
I totally agree with that. But what they're saying now is if you're out of network, we're not going to pay you. You know, that's like having a hospital contract, and if you're going out of network, saying, well, yeah, you can go out of network, but we're not going to pay you. And that's...
Well, they are getting paid, but again, the dentist has the decision to make. And that may be for various reasons that they don't want to be in the network. You know, maybe their business is full and they don't need to accept any other state clients. But I think that this is a business decision. I don't see any problem with this because what we're saying.
Probably not paying them.
They are getting paid. They're getting paid at a different rate. It's just like if you.
Well, no, different rate than a finalist. It's 40
different
months,
rate
40 weeks.
And it's
late.
A different time. It's a different time frame. So. So there's incentives to take a lower rate, but you get your money faster. I mean, it's just like what we do with FQHC. They get an extra amount in a quicker way because we've determined that is how we're going to reimburse FQHC.
I don't think they don't get a lower rate, so it's just the
they get a higher rate in that case. But I'm saying that there's different time frames and there's different rates that we pay providers all the time. I think it's just a part of the model of doing business in healthcare. I don't have any concern on this.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Magellan Behavioral Health.
Good morning. Julie Billingsley, Magellan Health Services. We administer the behavioral health services for the indemnity plan as well as the EAP for the state non-AFSCME Council 31 employees.
Okay. Any questions of the commission? I'll go back to the standard question here. Do you have any pending regulatory issues with any state agency, or are you under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state Attorney General's office?
Not that I'm aware of.
How have the claims hold issue affected your responsibilities under the contract?
We continue to pay claims. We process claims and pay claims in a timely manner. There's no claims hold on the behavioral health side.
Okay. What's a timely manner?
Within 30 days.
Okay. And what changes exist in your renewed contract for 2014?
There are no changes. Rates remain the same.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. I think the last one says our life insurance contracts for fiscal year 2014, Minnesota Life.
Last but not least, right? Good morning. My name is Becca Nix. I'm the branch manager here at the Springfield office for Minnesota Life.
Okay, any questions? All right, once again, do you have any pending regulatory issues with any state agency, or are you under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state attorney's general office?
No, we're not.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And yeah. I think seeing.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thank you. And Co-Chair Tracy, I think, has a follow-up. Maybe, well,
I had a follow-up question with CMS because I did want to make sure that we, you know, I had posed the question to Cigna and actually it was to the broader of complaints by employees and the like. And then I think Senator brought it to my attention that it was the state who logs in, and perhaps that comes from the Department of Insurance, whatever. I'm just trying to get input as to the number of claims that we receive from employees or retirees under the existing health insurance benefits and the resolutions.
The number of complaints that we receive. I have a single unit that they spend all day on the phone with members. I can pull data for you that tells you what kind of phone calls we get and what kind of written correspondence we get on a daily, monthly basis. We don't differentiate those by carrier, but I can certainly get that data for you. It is, depending on what's going on, claims hold, it's a bit of a staggering number for a unit that has five people.
Okay, so I suppose the claims hold has actually brought that number up. Is that correct?
We've been under a claims hold for 4 years, so yes. At this point, it has severely impacted the number of calls and the amount of correspondence that we receive.
I presume that the claims hold has gotten greater this year than previous years. Would that be accurate?
It is greater, but as Marcia testified to, we're working very hard to make it consistent. Previously, it was a little bit, you know, we pay this person sooner than this person, and we've worked very hard to try to make it consistent across all the plans.
Thank you. Do we know, since the Medicaid Advantage, Medicare Advantage has only been negotiated with AFSCME, do we know as we go on with other union groups and negotiations how that will affect it, or is that going to be perceived as the plan we're going with for all the other unions, or what do you see in this area?
The state is only bound to negotiate health care with AFSCME. We do not negotiate health care with the other unions. I simply go to their negotiations and present them the plan for the fiscal year.
Thank you.
All right, seeing no other business before the commission, let's meet the Commissioner of Government Forecasting and Accountability. We'll stand adjourned.